Tonight on Arena. Alexander Skarsgård gets on his bike with Pillion, Stranger Things gets even stranger, and new Jessie J, Ella Eyre and David Keenan. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. Email arena at rte.ie. We are on Instagram at rte_arena. TV and album reviews to come. You're very welcome along to Friday night's Arena, but first we start with a little treat. Alexander Skarsgård has perhaps cornered the market when it comes to devilishly handsome but morally ambiguous alpha males, with career-making roles in True Blood, Succession and The Northman. His latest film, Pillion, has caused a stir at Cannes. It premiered earlier this year and he's been steadily generating buzz ever since. In it, Skarsgård plays Ray, an enigmatic stranger with a taste for motorbikes and domination of all kinds. Early in the film, he tempts Harry Melling's mild-mannered parking attendant Colin into a relationship of sorts, which hinges entirely on Colin's aptitude for devotion. As their romance develops, Colin goes on a journey of self-discovery through his local kinky biker scene, a phrase I did not think I was going to say on the radio this week. The film opens in cinemas today, and earlier Sinead Egan spoke to Alexander Skarsgård about his work on the film. Before we hear that conversation, let's listen to a scene from it. Here, Ray arrives to collect Colin for a date, and Colin's parents, played by Douglas Hodge and Leslie Sharp, can't believe their eyes.
Gosh, you're tall. Sorry, Peggy, Peggy, Peter, nice to meet you.
Ray.
How do you do?
Time for a quick drink?
No, thank you. Not when I'm writing.
No, of course not. Oh, what was I thinking? Yeah. Oh, good lad, yeah. Well, something soft.
We better get going.
Yeah. You don't sound local, Ray. Where's home?
Chislehurst.
Chislehurst? Oh, it's very nice.
I've never thought of Colin as a Chislehurst sort of person.
Nah, he'll survive. All right. Come on then, Colin.
All right, you just...
All right, hey.
Oh, Ray, sorry to fuss, but you do have a spare helmet, yes?
Yes.
Only he actually has to wear it.
Dad. Because he's not getting on without one.
He is not getting on without one.
Great. Nice bike. Plain black. None of this neon crap like you see everywhere nowadays, don't you?
Colin?
Yep. Yeah. You sure you know what you're doing?
Yeah, don't worry, Dad.
I'm not worried. I rode a bike when I met Colin's mum. And I sold it when the twins come along. Bought a very expensive pram. Well, I don't suppose you two need to worry about that. Not yet, anyway.
Alexander Skarsgård, welcome to Arena. You've talked about how much the script for Pillion appealed to you when you first read it. You liked how the narrative progressed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was so surprised when I started reading it. I had heard that it was a BDSM sub-dom story, but I didn't expect it to be so tender and so sweet and so funny and so awkward.
Yeah.
I think often when that subculture is depicted on screen and in books, it's often either very shocking, very kind of extreme. It's often it can either be super sexy or sexy, but verging on something dangerous. And it's like an ominous tone to it. And I thought it was so refreshing to read it. Yes, there were definitely thrilling and sexy and exciting moments in it, but that Harry Lighton, who wrote the screenplay, left space for so much awkwardness and tenderness and all these mundane moments brushing up against the more extreme moments was something that I really gravitated towards.
You coined this new cinematic genre, the dom-com, which is it's a really great phrase. But it hints at this tricky balancing act that you were just talking about. So how did you and Harry Lighton ensure that the leather and the kink didn't overpower this genuine sweetness and loveliness that is in the script?
Well, if you work with Harry Melling, it's hard to kind of to not feel sweetness and tenderness, because he's just such a delightful human being and so lovely and sweet and fun to work with. So it definitely wasn't a stretch for me as an actor to kind of find those moments. They came very naturally in working with Harry. And we didn't really talk much about it in pre-production. Harry, it's confusing because they're both Harrys, but Harry yeah. Melling plays Colin, and I didn't really meet before we shot, or we didn't talk before we shot the movie. So we met, there's a big wrestling scene in the movie. That was when we rehearsed that 2 days before we started shooting. It was actually the first time Melling and I met, which was kind of interesting because it meant that the discovery of this relationship for the two of us, the two actors, actually happened in front of the camera, because I never knew, because we hadn't discussed it at all, Harry and I never knew how he was going to react in those scenes or how he interpreted those moments, which gave him some real nerve and often quite surprising moments for me in the scene where I expected it would go in a specific direction and it completely surprised me. And that was lovely.
The film kind of strips away all these usual hallmarks of cinematic romance. You know, there's no candlelit dinners. There's no traditional courtship. So you're just talking about Harry Melling. How did you build intimacy with him as Colin when you strip away all those romantic comedy crutches that we're used to?
Yeah, I think there are some romantic, like Harry Lytton, when he wrote it, we even have like a classic Richard Curtis falling in love montage, but it happens towards the end of the movie as opposed to like end of the first act, which was really fun to shoot. But yeah, like I said, it starts out in a different way. It starts out, it's more my character Ray takes Colin on as a submissive. So the getting to know each other phase is more about Colin learning the ropes, figuring out how to, because he's obviously a willing participant in this. He wants to be Ray's sub, but it's his first adventure. Kind of, it's his first time. He's very inexperienced, so he doesn't really know what the rules are, and he learns as the relationship develops what is expected of him. And so, the getting to know each other bit was, it starts out, yeah, like very graphic with an intimate scene in a back alley, and that's basically their first date. And then we're kind of off to the races.
Can we talk a little bit about Ray more specifically? And he's so self-assured. He has this predatory stillness. What decisions did you and Harry Lytton make about him before he started filming? Like, I'm curious about where the piano playing came from and the Karl Ove Knausgård. Where did those little notes come from?
Well, we wanted to keep Ray enigmatic, and we were sure about, we never wanted a big reveal, like where you find out something about Ray's past. I was drawn to the idea that you never really learn much about Ray, but we also wanted to kind of have little hints or stuff that the audience can, you can see a glimpse of something else. We obviously didn't want Ray to come across as like one note throughout the movie, where it's just like, because enigmatic can also border on, it can just feel boring because you're impenetrable. You don't get to know the character. It was important, obviously, to at least in moments root for Ray and Colin to be together. And otherwise, it wouldn't, I think, be an interesting journey if you just think that like Ray is weird and closed off and cold, and you just want Colin to move on. So we also wanted to go against Ray's stereotype that you first meet with, and plant little seeds, almost like a mystery. Like there are little things in the apartment that could potentially reveal something. And the fact that a character like Ray is trying to learn the piano and he's reading Knausgård might be surprising elements to the character when you first meet him. The reading glasses aren't like the macho style glasses that you kind of expect from someone like Ray. And so we're trying to kind of break the stereotype a little bit.
The journey in the film really does belong to Harry Melling's character, Colin, and there's no big personal discovery for Ray. He is who he is. So as an actor, does that make it harder to approach a role when he doesn't really change over the time of the film? He's very much his own person. He knows who he is from beginning to end.
I wouldn't say it was hard. It was quite exciting to me. Back to the fact that there wasn't a big climactic moment, a big reveal where Ray breaks down and tells Colin about his husband or his wife and two kids back home. Like, I felt like that would have been not a narrative trap, but like a kind of a, many versions of this movie would have had that moment,
yeah,
because it's like a big climactic moment towards the end of the second act. You have this thing and it's a big, you know, fight scene or whatever. Even though this is Harry's Lighton's first screenplay, his first feature, it felt like so, it radiated confidence to avoid those tropes in a way. And the exciting challenge for me was, again, to try to instill life into this enigmatic character and avoid playing the same note throughout. I wanted to feel, if not vulnerability or fragility, but something bordering on it, maybe for the audience, that you can feel that there is something under the surface and there might be more to Ray than meets the eye. And that was quite an interesting challenge to take on it.
The film is really respectful and affectionate towards gay biker culture and members of actual gay biker groups were involved in the film. They worked with you on loads of the scenes. What was it like to work with them and what insights did they give you about your role as Ray?
So GBMCC, Gay Bikers Motorcycle Club, were involved. They were very gracious and let Harry Lighton tag along with them when he was writing the screenplay in order to give it authenticity. And they were very extraordinarily generous with their time in pre-production and during production, because again, like you said, they're also in the movie, a bunch of the members of the club. And Harry got to join them on a couple of excursions as he was writing the screenplay, and they were incredibly incredibly generous with their time, both in pre-production and during production. Again, they a couple of the members of GBMCC and a few of the guys from the London Kink scene are in the movie and were just instrumental in obviously shaping the world and giving it authenticity and everything about like the broad narrative to the tone of it to bringing props to an orgy to make it feel real. And it was important to kind of let them be also individuals and not just like a representation of a group, to distinguish these bikers and the guys, Paul and the guys from the London Kink scene, that they all, we didn't want it to feel like they're all the same or like they represent the same thing. And it was important to, again, distinguish them from each other. And all the couples are different. So Ray and Colin are not affectionate with each other, but it was important, like, for example, in the scene post the orgy in the woods, you see the other couples around the bonfire hugging and kissing and being affectionate with each other. And that was important because, and also we wanted mundane moments of them just like being childish and playing and having fun. And because again, I think often when this subculture is depicted, it's often in a very extreme and shocking way. And having gotten to know these guys, they're also very normal,
yeah,
in many ways. And
that totally comes across.
Yeah. And I think that was important to kind of instill into the film.
Finally, I just want to ask you about your red carpet looks for promoting the film. They've been playful and on occasion they've been really, really daring. It seems that you're having a lot of fun with it. Can you tell me about how you worked on those looks and whether you're ever going to go back to a simple black tuxedo?
Well, I wore a simple black tuxedo the other night, actually. And I think it's just like, it can be, when you're on a press tour, and we've been fortunate enough to travel to a lot of film festivals with Pillion, It can be monotonous and exhausting, and it just like instills a little bit of fun and life into it when you can play around with the outfits. And rather than just like bringing five different black, gray, navy suits, you can actually like be a bit more playful with it. And I've quite enjoyed that. And I'm obviously not like playing the character from the movie. I'm not Ray on the red carpet, but it's no doubt have I been inspired by the movie and by working with these guys from GBMCC. And yeah, I think it's like, it's kind of a little bit spur of the moment, depending on how, what I want to wear. Sometimes it's a bit more, maybe not conservative, but I have enjoyed it. I definitely have.
You can tell. Listen, Alexander Skarsgård, congratulations on the film. And thank you so much for talking to Arena this evening.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
Well, actually, there was something. I was wondering if maybe you might want to come have dinner with my parents sometime.
Dinner with your parents?
Yeah.
And you'd like that?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, they would.
Yeah. I don't think that's a very good idea.
Okay. Maybe be persuaded, you know? Could it be like a birthday present, maybe?
I hope you're not expecting a birthday present, Colin.
No, I'm not. It's just Mum, she wants to meet you properly. And she's quite ill, you know. She's dying, actually, but I don't want to force you to...
No?
No.
Okay. Well, it sounds like that is exactly what you're trying to do here.
No, I'm not.
You are. You are.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you.
Oh, you couldn't upset me if you tried.
And that was Alexander Skarsgård with Harry Melling in a scene from The Wonderful Pillion. It goes on general release in cinemas today. And congratulations to the Irish producers of the film Element Pictures. They announced this evening the film has received 10 nominations for the British Independent Film Awards, including Best Supporting Performance for Alexander Skarsgård. We'll take a look at this week's brand new TV after this. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. On tonight's TV reviews, Netflix drops the fifth and final season of Stranger Things, the hit sci-fi horror series. Set in 1987, this time in Hawkins, Indiana, it follows Eleven, Mike, Dustin, Lucas, Will and Max as they confront Vecna's ruthless upside-down conquest, facing vanishing traps and threats in a desperate fight to save their town. And the Beatles anthology, the definitive documentary series, arrives restored and expanded on Disney Plus, narrated by the band members themselves. It chronicles their journey from their humble Liverpool origins to global superstars and their eventual acrimonious breakup. A new ninth episode presents previously unseen footage of Paul, George and Ringo reflecting on their legacy. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have watched both and join me now. There are people who took the day off on Thursday for the launch of the final season of Stranger Things. Chris, before we talk about it, can you give me a potted history of the series first, in case people wanted to catch up?
Okay, how long do we have?
At least 40 minutes. Go.
Stranger Things, it's Spielbergian. It's a little Joe Dante, like it's a little Stephen King, like it's set in 1980s and it's set in the 1980s in a town called Hawkins, Indiana, where some very strange happenings are taking place in a parallel world that some of the residents will soon refer to as the Upside Down. So you've got basically four kids who love Dungeons and Dragons. They love sci-fi. They love fantasy. They love to play games, you know, where heroes, you know, are vanquishing monsters. But they don't ever realize that they might end up in sort of one of those situations themselves. And it's all to do with some sort of super shady secret government operation that involves telekinetic kids and kids with, you know, psychokinetic powers. 11, Millie Bobby Brown's character, comes into it, befriends this, you know, ragtag team of nerdy misfits. And they basically just try to, you know, kill demons that are coming out of this upside down world. You've had basically four seasons, dozens of hours worth of televisions, because you think to yourself, well, eight episodes, there's only going to be 40 minutes. Some Stranger Things episodes go, you know, are feature length. And it's kind of followed the same plot all along. You know, the disappearance of one of the characters, Will Byers, a cop played by David Harper, his name is Jim Hopper, who becomes the surrogate father to one of the kids with superpowers. Winona Ryder playing the mother of one of the kids who disappeared. We've basically just been with these kids for the last 10 years, but in the series, only 4 years have passed. So season five picks up at a point where the residents of Hawkins, Indiana now know, everyone outside of this little band knows, that something strange is happening in this town.
Okay, Jen, the series has been going on for quite some time, and the Duffer brothers, who write and run it, they've kept the same cast all the way through. Has that become a problem now that we've reached this series in terms of their age?
Oh, has it become a problem? Big time. Hawkins, we have a problem. Like, we find ourselves, we're 9 years later in a timeline that makes absolutely no sense. It's only, like Chris was saying, supposed to be 4 years since season one took place. And these cute kids don't cut it as winsome teens because they're in their 20s. The jig is up. We've seen them grow. Millie Bobby Brown is a mother now, you guys. 11 isn't 11. So, I mean, the suspension of disbelief here has to come into play. It's like when you were watching Grease and you were watching 30-year-olds running around a high school. And also, can I just say, I know that in the new season, Hawkins is closed off, basically quarantined from the outside world. But does that mean they have no access to hairdressers? Because the wigs be wigging in this show right now. And they are a truly appalling selection of wigs trying to disguise these kids that have that are now in their 20s. And we're supposed to believe that they're 15 years old. And they're trying to do it with the wardrobe, but it feels like they're jumping out of those clothes. Like, and I feel like the actors themselves are chomping at the bit trying to get this done so they can be released into the real world and get new roles. And that also plays into how you see the acting too. And I have to say, maybe because they were children in seasons one and two, you could, you know, they felt like they were getting swept away in the story themselves and their acting was innocent, naive, exciting, believable. But now either the dialogue has changed or maybe they haven't progressed as actors because some of them can't carry the emotional weight that this season needs them to have. And I'm talking in particular about Noah Schnapp as Will Byers, who was this central character in season one as he disappeared, went missing. And now he is really the emotional centre of this final season. And I just don't know if he is up to that task at all. And you can see those cracks.
OK, let's take a listen to something from it. This is 11 in training.
12 minutes, 33 seconds.
It's a new record. So, how are we feeling? Okay? Okay. God, that was 12:33.
It's 4 seconds too slow. I lost 1 second on the climb, 2 seconds at the log.
Hey.
I can make my bus jump sooner. That'll save me 2 more seconds. That gets me under 12:30.
L, you have to take it easy on yourself.
You think Henry's going easy?
You know what I think? I think we still have some more of that waffle mix. And I think we should celebrate this record time with a stack of those. And then maybe we could watch a Miami Vice marathon.
That's Millie Bobby Brown as 11, David Harbour as Jim Hopper, and Winona Ryder as Joyce Byers. And there lies one of the situations in this, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
David Harbour is a very different person now than he would have been, let's say, 6 weeks ago. Does that in any way get in the way of your watching of this? And for anybody who doesn't understand, it's his ex-wife Lily Allen's album and the revelations that occurred in that.
It didn't for me, no. Sometimes I think it's like we live at a time now where we know far too much about the actors we're watching on television and on film. And if we allow every personal detail of those, you know, online lives to get in the way of performances, we're going to be ruined. We're not going to enjoy anything anymore. So I did have to push it aside. I think the problem for me in that scene is actually the writing. I think The Duffers a few years back before season four, I think at one point was going to be the last season of Stranger Things, or at least a lot of people thought it would be. And The Duffer Brothers came out, Matt and Ross Duffer, and said, there's too much story to tell. We need to do this over 5 seasons. So they put out a season four that was 13 hours long. And just to give you an idea of how stretched Stranger Things is, that's double the length of the first season of Stranger Things. And what they've done with this one is put out another 13 hours because this we've got four episodes this week. 3 episodes are going to be released on Christmas Day and then a big feature-length bumper finale on New Year's Day. They're basically padding things out and they're stretching and straining the story as far as they can go because, you know, good things are not allowed to end. And it really shows. So you've got scenes like the one you just listened to where nothing's happening. Mm. And, you know, they're showing us Eleven's powers. We've had 10 years to see Eleven's powers. They're showing us that Hopper is the father figure to Eleven. We know that. So there's just far too much padding. And I think if the Duffer Brothers explain too much with their writing, their directing in the first couple of episodes, it's too much. They over-exaggerate everything. Every boot on the ground is a big wallop. Every character introduction is so dramatic. To the point where you're thinking, if everything is dramatic here, then nothing is. And it's not until the third episode when Frank Darabont, how the heck they convince Frank Darabont to come out of retirement to direct 2 episodes of Stranger Things. Apparently he's a fan. He's a proper director. It's when he is behind the camera that things, now I didn't love it, but it settles. It's, you know, you've got actually someone who knows how to make a film or knows how to make a series in charge. And it really does show. Unfortunately, I just don't think there's enough story there for the season.
There isn't. It feels like you're saying, we haven't moved on at all. And in the beginning, Stranger Things was this show that was supposed to be about conspiracies and the panic that would arise from these things actually happening. But no one in Hawkins seems to care that, like, their world is coming apart. It's as if this should be international news, regardless, or at least a national news. And it loses the momentum that build-up should have, where everybody's waking up to the fact that these group of kids were actually right and there is a big bad out there that has to be destroyed. Or maybe it's supposed to be a reflect in real life, where if something cataclysmic happens, we like to turn a blind eye collectively. I don't know, but I think it hasn't added to our understanding of the realm of Hawkins, of the realm of the Upside Down, or the mechanics, or the metaphor. It hasn't helped. It hasn't moved on. And I feel like the storyline it just feels like one giant episode. It's a behemoth. And if you're trying to reacquaint yourself with Stranger Things and you're hopping in on the buzz because this is the final season, good luck to you. Because it is so lost in its own lore.
I had to look at the catch-up trailer in advance before I watched the first episode because I'd pretty much forgotten what's gone on at the end of the
previous
season. That's
the thing. And I really feel like it's a show about nostalgia, but it feels like the Duffers are nostalgic about their own show, first season.
Okay, before I ask you for stars, Chris, for somebody who's never watched Stranger Things, there is obviously no way you can jump in at this point.
No, you would have
to go back to the beginning and work your way up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, you risk like the mother of all headaches if you try and watch season 5 without watching the other 4. But what I will say is, go back. It sounds like we're hating on Stranger Things. We're not really.
The first season,
I think if we going into 2026, we could be on this show next year if Stranger Things had just been a miniseries, saying that Stranger Things was the greatest miniseries of all time, because there was enough story there, and the character development, the acting, the special effects, everything about that first season I loved. I wanted them to just leave it there. And I just think everyone involved got a little too greedy. And just to touch on something that Jen said there, all the special effects in the world, though, can't change the fact that, unfortunately, everyone's too old for this. I wasn't distracted by David Harbour. I was distracted by the fact that one of the actors here, who's supposed to be in his early 20s, is just 2 years younger than me. I'm not going to say how old I am. But and I just thought, it's a bit ridiculous, guys. It's time to wrap this up.
Okay, give me some stars.
At the same time, look, event television it doesn't get any bigger than this. There are parts where it is very well made. I do wish it all the best, because at least now it's finishing. I'm going to give it 3 and best of luck to it.
Yeah. Okay, I loved when it was like a little, like, deep strain of weird 80s in the first season, where it felt like unsolved mysteries, flowers in the attic, you know, milk, missing kids, you know, on milk cartons, that kind of 80s that you felt that they were tapping into. And this is just overblown. It's too much. It's arrested development. That's what Stranger Things is suffering from, unfortunately. And I really thought it was charming, but now it's way too bloated and out of control. So 3.
Okay, 3 from you. We're going to move on to the Beatles anthology. It's a new, and I'm using that in quotation marks, documentary series on Disney. It started when Paul, George and Ringo sat down in 1991 to document the band's history on their own terms following John Lennon's death in 1980. Jen, tell us about this.
Yeah, I mean, what is there left to say about the Beatles? I hope Sam Mendes is asking himself that very question before we go into these 4 films that I'm not looking forward to, that I'm also calling Lord of the Ringos, because this is what we're getting from this. I mean, there is no new angle left. We've had endless podcasts, documentaries about the terror and brilliance of the Beatles, but this was unique at the time. I remember this from the first time around because I used to watch it when I was little at home. If you're from a family like mine, you did see this on the BBC every week and you had the videos to prove it. So this was them in their own words. It was such a massive cultural moment because it was the first time the band members had sat down properly and put a shape on their own shared history. And it was the telling of that story that's unfolding in this basic chronological fashion, but it's interspliced with interviews with them from the 90s, with them telling their own version of events or how they remembered certain incidences. And that's why it was so brilliant. And that's why it drew viewers in. But it doesn't have have the same impact right now, because I think you can fire up YouTube and see any of these clips now. So it loses that pizzazz that it had back then, because back then you thought this is the only chance we'll get for this definitive story to happen.
That's a crucial question, isn't it, Chris? Because it felt a little bit like a holy grail in 1995, but now it's at your fingertips.
Yeah, it's so strange because this was actually the beginning of the Beatles franchise as we know it now. You know, this was the first time that someone was kind of stepping in and going, maybe we should reissue some of the Beatles catalogue. Maybe we should go looking in the vault for some magic. We might find some. And we did. But 30 years later, it's like, I don't think there's really anything left. But it's difficult to overestimate just how big a deal this was when it came out, because it was the Beatles in a room, 3 out of 4 of them, sadly, in a room saying that, listen, we're getting to a point now with documentary making where someone's going to try and tell our story. So let's try and get ahead of that. You know, you had Apple Music in the 70s wanting to do something. The Three Guys said no. Enough time had passed, and they even talk about it here in the 9th episode where they said, let's actually get into the studio. Apparently they put together about 5,000 hours worth of footage for this thing, so good luck to anyone, or good luck to the editors. But if episodes 1 to 8, which existed in the 90s and have been cleaned up here, not edited in any way, just remastered, so you know, just given a slight polish so it looks and sounds amazing, if episode 1 to 8 is about what it was like to be a Beatle, episode 9 is about the after party. It's about basically how George and Ringo and Paul came together again as friends and musicians, and how they kind of coped without John being there. And I know there have been critics saying that it's comprised of footage that, you know, you would have previously seen on a DVD. They've just kind of edited and stuck the whole thing together. I didn't really care, because for me it has one of the most powerful scenes of the entire documentary. And there's a scene where the three of them have just recorded a new song together at George Harrison's house. They've been jamming, they've been chatting for the first time in ages, they're sitting in the garden drinking tea, and Ringo turns around to Paul and George and says, I really like hanging out with you guys. And I just thought that was so moving, because you forget that the Beatles are so important to me. You, Rick, you, Jen, the songs have now taken on a different life. There are songs, they're not the Beatles anymore. But you kind of forget that the lads who gave those tunes, they didn't set out to change the world, they didn't set out to change our lives. They just liked hanging out with each other. And I just found that so beautiful.
Let's take something from it. This is John and Paul from that 9th episode. They're reminiscing about discovering Elvis for the first time and about how he changed everything.
When I went to art school, I was at art school for 5 years. When I went to, this is a sort of college, I went in there, they would only allow jazz to be played. You know, they wouldn't allow rock and roll in. It was frowned upon those days. So we had to con them into letting us play rock and roll there on the record player by calling it blues, you know.
Well, that's all right, mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right.
I remember being in school when I was a kid, and somebody had a picture in one of the musical papers of Elvis. And I just looked at him and just thought, he's just so good looking. He just looked perfect.
When I was 16, Elvis is what was happening. A guy with long, greasy hair, wiggling his ass and singing Hound Dog and That's All Right Mama on those early Sun records, which I think are his great period.
That's him. That is the guru we have been waiting for. The Messiah has arrived.
You ain't nothing but a
Just hearing the voice there, Jen, the absence of John Lennon runs through everything in this series.
Yeah, it does. And I think, I mean, there's great life-affirming moments within this series. I mean, clips of the songs that are hits that are in our bloodstream. But I think the thing about the Beatles is the reason why we keep on going back to their story is, I think it's because we can't quite believe it. And I think we keep thinking that if we retell it, they'll retell it in some kind of way that will reveal the magic and that we can't put our finger on, and something will happen, that there'll be a truth, a germ of genius that we didn't know about that will be revealed. But I think the greatest thing about the Beatles is they're so ordinary. They were dead ordinary, and it happened to just these lads that you feel like you could have known. And their music was a way of communicating with each other, with the outside world. And the songwriting, the power of that just became bigger than all of them, and in a frightening way. And I think that's what this shows as well, which is really important. George Harrison talks about how the Beatles destroyed their young nervous systems, not being able to grow up, not being able to live privately. And I think what I love watching about the anthology itself is the world trying to come to terms with the Beatles. You have footage of these teens unleashing hormones in an uncontrollable, very violent fashion, and the images of those crowds crushing together, of a girl being carried by a policeman through a crowd, passed out with one shoe on, Ringo being engulfed by a crowd of teenagers. He's holding on to his door knocker of his house for dear life. He's being subsumed into it, and the older generation being completely baffled by them, these young lads who are like taking the mick all the time and baffled by the chaos that they caused. And I think that never gets old when you see how they changed the world in that way. They changed, they raised the game. And I think, like, my dad, who was a massive Beatles fan, he used to always say they didn't have time to be bad. And that's the thing, and that's the greatest thing about them. They did all this in such a short space of time. When you think about it, in those interviews that they're doing, they're in their 50s, they're the same age as, like, say, Noel and Liam Gallagher, only going back to former glories. But they were going back to those former glories of albums that changed the world, and they only did it in such a slim amount of time. It's fascinating.
Okay, I need to get stars from both of you, Jen.
I mean, look, I would always go back to Get Back. I think what Peter Jackson did was something truly phenomenal. This is not that. This is something way more rigid and a bit stuffy, but the stories are still there. There's still some great tales, obviously. So, I mean, it's hard not to give it a 5, but I'll give it a 4.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the same. I just found it absolute magic. I'll never tire of listening to those stories. And I love the way that this documentary looks at the fact that the Beatles, when they, you know, when they cracked America, when they made it, they were thinking, how are we going to cope with this? Whereas the rest of the world were thinking, what are we going to do next? Now that we've experienced this, we're never going to be able to get over it. And we were still here 60 years later trying to figure it out. 5 stars.
Okay. Chris Wasser, Jen Gannon, thanks so much for joining me. The Beatles Anthology is streaming on Disney Plus, and the first 4 episodes of Stranger Things are on Netflix now. And you're welcome back to Arena. Friday night is Music Night. We have 3 brand new albums up for review. First up, Dundalk singer-songwriter David Keenan, who returns with a 4th album called Modern Mythologies. Ella Eyre was first signed to a record company when she was 16. She won a Brit when she was 19 and then took a decade off from the industry. With her new album, she says she's had to unlearn everything she'd been taught about music. And we'll also review Jessie J's new release, best known for lung-busting songs like Price Tag and as being a judge on The Voice. She is back with Don't Tease Me With A Good Time. Listen to these albums on our behalf. And joining us in studio, Nadine O'Regan and Simon Marr. Let's start with the David Keenan album, Modern Mythologies. Nadine, who is David Keenan?
He's a singer-songwriter from Dundalk. He's been around quite a while, actually. This is his 4th record. For his first 2 records, he was signed to Ruby Works, which is the same label that also has Hozier on its books. So, you know, I think for a while, certainly back in 2020, he was really being heralded as a bright new talent in the mould of somebody maybe like Damien Rice or David Gray. And I think he would say himself, and he has said, he's a little bit more unpredictable than that. Doesn't necessarily want the spotlight on him if the spotlight is before an auditorium of thousands. He's actually very happy. He's been on tour recently playing to very tiny pubs around the country, and he's somebody who is a little bit of a wanderer. He's lived in different places. He's busked on the streets of London, and he's played his craft in, I suppose, many different ways. So a lot of different influences go to make up this record, and probably a lot of different lessons as well, because he's been, I think, he's had the highs and lows of the music industry experience.
Okay, before we start digging into it, let's have a listen to a little bit of David Keenan. This is from the new album. It's called Poison Water. That's David Keenan, and that's Poison Water from Modern Mythologies. Simon, so how would you describe this album? What are we getting here?
You know, it's a series of stories about Ireland and maybe small town Ireland and everything that's happened in it. It's all the way through to sort of big societal changes, all the way through to the arrival of the Dodgy Box, right? So it's everything, and it's all referenced in there, and it's a series of stories that are told. And I suppose the difference between this and previous outings is probably musically that it's much fuller than previous albums have been. It's obvious that you're hearing some pretty decent percussion, and there's some good guitar work and everything that's gone into it. So while the stories are the same, and they're all quite simple stories a lot of the time, now it feels like it's a fuller telling of those stories.
And Nadine, he's a Dundalk man. His gorgeous accent is something that shines through on this.
Yeah, although to be honest, his accent wasn't really what I noticed. And I was chatting to Simon actually before we came in. And I've talked to a few other people this week about this record because I'm rarely so uncertain when reflecting how I feel about an album. Because this album for me, when I hear his vocal, I don't really think about his accent. I think about his vocal phrasing. And I grew up being, you know, a huge fan of people like David Gray, the early first three albums where he was more acoustic, and also being a fan of The Frames and Glenn Hansard, then Damien Rice. And so for me, what I keep hearing on this record is a very uncanny sort of vocal phrasing that brings to mind those artists, along with other artists like, say, Mundy, Mike Scott. And it's tricky for me because that element of the sort of the magpie, if you like, whether it's done consciously or consciously, makes me think of the other artist and pulls me out of the song. So I don't know what somebody who doesn't have those records in their collection would, I don't know how they would feel about this record. But for me, there's this sort of tissue of, I suppose, or melange of like different records coming together, which is unsettling.
Yeah, this might counterpoint that. It's quite interesting. Have a listen to this. This is another song from the album. It's called We Live, We Learn, We Love.
You fully express your mind.
That's We Live, We Learn, We Love from David Keenan. That kind of illustrates it, doesn't it, Simon?
It does. That's David Gray. You know, that's where that comes from. And I think Nadine made a really good point as to whether it's conscious or unconscious that it's happening. Because when I went and I listened back to album number three, and it's not merely like that. There isn't the songs, the stories are the same. His vocal is the same, but there isn't the familiarity and that weird question mark familiarity through it. And I don't think it really doesn't help this album, because the stories themselves are lovely. I love the stories in here, but I'm just not sure about the delivery.
Okay, let's get stars from you.
I'm going to give it a 2.5.
Okay, Nadine.
3.
Okay, Ella Eyre was still a teenager when she bagged her first Brit Award. It's taken her 10 years to release a new album, claiming she had to unlearn everything she was told the first time around and start all over again. She's still only 31. She lost her voice and had to undergo serious surgery on her vocal cords, and now makes her return with the new album called Everything in Time. Let's have a listen to this. This is the title track. Everything in Time from Ella Eyre. Simon, she was once told by a music exec that she couldn't write songs. It's another example of the way that young women are treated by the music industry. Has she proved that individual wrong?
I think she has. No, I think definitely given the story that she has, and given the fact that she had the courage to say stop, she could have just been that guest vocalist forever. She's got a particular style all of her own. But the fact that she stopped and said, look, I'm going to do this and I'm going to reassert myself, that she's gone and she's written songs, she's written stories here, and they're stories of that last 10 years. And I think in the main, she's written these very well.
Hey, Nadine, what do you make of the album?
I really like its springy sort of energy. The Amy Winehouse reference point is there, but she's got kind of bigger lungs. She can hit the back of the auditorium when she sings, and it's a very elastic vocal. I mean, she's the person who brought us Just Get Paid, which is the song that will always be on in a nightclub somewhere in the world. And you can hear that. You can hear how talented she is. I like the way this album is sort of straightforward in that it's sort of giving you these tunes that flow quite effortlessly one to the other. She's not necessarily going, oh, this is the downbeat section of the album and now this is the light. She's really like, no, I'm kind of bouncy, I'm springy. She gets to choruses at 40 seconds almost always.
Yeah, yeah.
So she knows how to work radio, and she wants this album to play well, not just on Spotify or radio, but on Shazam. She wants it to get picked up. She's ambitious, and I kind of applaud that. But the one thing I would say is she's playing for very high stakes in this arena, because pop is a crowded genre. There's a lot of people like her, and actually talent isn't always necessarily what makes a star. Sometimes it's something more awkward sometimes. So I think she is very talented, and I like this record, but I don't know if it's going to do enough to pole vault her to that arena crowd that she wants.
Okay, let's get some stars from you.
I'm going to go 3, but okay. A good 3.
Simon.
Yeah, I particularly enjoy this record, and I love the fact that she is taking that chance. So I'm giving her 3.5 on this.
Okay, to Jessie J and her album Don't Tease Me With A Good Time. She is the British singer with the amazing voice who parlayed success with the likes of Bang Bang, Domino, and Price Tag into a whole other career as a talent show. show Judge. People will know her career away from singing, a judge on The Voice in the UK and on Dancing with the Stars in Australia. I'm going to take something from this and then we'll see what we make of it. This is called Living My Best Life. Jessie J's Living My Best Life. Is this a sort of return to form, Nadine?
You know what? I'm the wrong person to ask because I like. I think sometimes when you're reviewing, you have to be fair to the artist and say, "Look, is she am I the right audience for her as well?" Because as an artist, you have to find your audience, and I wouldn't say I'm her natural audience. That particular track, I do like the whooshy synths. I like the fact that it has an 80s vibe, and it could almost soundtrack like an old film like Mannequin, maybe. But by and large, for me, I really struggle with Jessie J. I think she is extraordinarily talented vocally. Those incredible abilities, suppleness, just everything. She has everything going for her. But sometimes if you have a really big palette of colours to play with, you don't know which one to pick. And I think sometimes limitations can be the making of an artist in that if you just have a few things and you can do them well and you have a bit of smarts, you can make a really good album. And I think with this particular record, I don't massively connect with it. I didn't find it that fascinating, even though I know she's going from extreme highs to extreme lows. She's talking about very difficult times in her life. And I felt kind of guilty, to be honest, that I didn't like it more. And I do wonder if I am I don't think I am the right audience, but I have to be honest and say, not really for me.
Simon, are you the right audience?
Doubtless no is the answer to that question. But, you know, I think I probably liked it that bit more. I think the thing I don't like about it is because her vocal is so good and it's spectacular. And there's a few songs on this that are very, very confessional and they're quite pared back. But still a lot of the same production toys are thrown at songs like that, the track that we just listened to. And it's such a shame because I think she has really good stories to tell. Obviously, she delivers them better than most do. But there's just something about it that it's like, let this thing breathe. Let her breathe. She is that good.
Okay, let's get some stars from you.
I'm going to give it 3 out of 5.
Nadine?
2.5.
2.5. We have been listening to David Keenan's Modern Mythologies, Ella Eyre's Everything in Time, and Jessie J's Don't Tease Me with a Good Time as well. Simon Marr, Nadine Regan, thank you very much for joining me tonight on Arena. And that is it for us for the week. If you'd like to listen back to anything that you'll have heard across the week on the programme, you can do that, of course, on the RTE Radio 1 website. You'll find all of the details there. Or you'll be able to find it on the RTE radio app as well. Listen back to all the things that we did across the course of the week. I'm Rick O'Shea. That's it for another week of Arena. Sinead Egan produced tonight's programme. The research was done by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton was our broadcast coordinator, and sound supervision tonight by Paul Murnock. Have yourself a wonderful and safe and fantastic weekend, and I'll see you next Monday from 7 here on Radio 1. John Creedon is next.